So I had just started working at Google, and I had to give a presentation to the founders and the CEO of the company about how the AdSense business was doing. Luckily for me, the AdSense business was on fire, and when I said how many new customers we had added over the last couple of months, Eric almost fell off his chair. So I'm feeling like the meeting's going all right. In fact, I now believe I'm a genius. I walked out of the room. I walked past my boss, who was Sheryl Sandberg, and I'm expecting a high five, a pat on the back. And eventually she said to me, "When you say every third word, it makes you sound stupid." Now she's got my full attention. And I realized in the case of Sheryl, it really boiled down to two things.
Well, folks, it's time to kick it old school. So you can feel cool. Give it to me, baby.
All right, guys, welcome back to another episode of Growth Minds. Today we have a very special guest coming in from SF as we do another remote interview, Kim Scott, who's the author of Radical Candor. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it was. It's really an honor. I first discovered your book, I think a few years ago, and I just loved how simple the message is, and particularly the way you have it in the cover, which is you've got these four quadrants, and of course we'll go into what the book is around, but the message, it seems, if I can simplify it, is that to become an effective leader and a leader that's more human, the idea is that you need to care personally, but also challenge directly. I'd be curious to know what the storyline is of how you decided to write a book like this.
It's really interesting. In many ways, my whole career in business was really a grand plan to subsidize my novel writing habit. So for a bunch of my career, I would work for a couple of years and then save up enough money to be able to stop working for a year and write a novel. And the novel writing never paid. And I really realized at a certain point that the thing that interested me about business was the same thing that interested me about writing novels, which is the question of how can we express who we are and create the kind of environment in which we want to live? And how can we be our best selves? And I realized that the opportunity of being a manager really gives you the chance to do that, to create this environment in which people can really love their work and even really love working with their colleagues. And so that was sort of what prompted me to write the book, was that I felt like I had so many ideas. The thing that motivated me at Google was not cost per click, although that was going pretty well, but it was really building the team and watching people grow and enjoy their careers and enjoy their lives. And so that was why I wrote the book. Another part of the reason why I wrote the book was that I became a CEO coach. And I was really lucky. I was coaching Dick Costolo and Drew at when he was CEO of Twitter, and Drew Houston at Dropbox, and Ryan Smith at Qualtrics. And I realized that coaching just doesn't scale. You can only coach a few people and do it effectively. But I had a lot of people asking me for help and advice, and all different kinds of people, including people just starting out in their management career and also quite advanced in their management career. And I realized that being a boss is really the same thing, whether you're just starting out or whether you're the CEO of a fast-growing big company. And it really boils down to you want to create a culture of feedback, you want to build a cohesive team, and you want to get stuff done. And those are the things that, you know, what do bosses do? A lot of people ask that question. So I decided that writing a book would scale better than being a CEO coach.
Sure. I'm curious to know what is a CEO coach? What's the responsibility of a CEO coach, and why do CEOs hire a coach?
So it's a good question, and I don't have a totally clear answer, but I think that the thing that I struggled with as a leader, and the thing that most of the people who I've coached struggle with as leaders is really figuring out sort of the human element, figuring out how who are the right people to promote, who are the right people to hire, how can I help this team sort of coalesce, how can I help this team, the people on the team get together better. And that, there's often so many it's sort of it's a particular kind of relationship that you have with each of your direct reports as a CEO or as a manager. And you don't really want to talk, if you're the CEO, you don't really want to talk to the board about the issues that you have with the people on your team, because very quickly you lose control of the situation. If you're a new manager, you don't want to talk to your boss necessarily about the problems that you're having with the people on your team. But you also can't talk to the one team member about another team member. That's a disaster. So you need to talk to someone. And usually, a therapist doesn't quite do it because they haven't been a boss themselves very often. And so they don't understand, like, how do you explain performance reviews to your, like, you wind up spending all your time giving context, instead of just being able to jump right in. So you could talk to your spouse or your significant other, but they usually get sick of hearing about all these work dramas. So that's really the job, is talking through the relationships that you're building at work, because that is at the core of what a leader's job is building great relationships with each of the direct reports and helping them build great relationships between each other.
I mean, as a CEO, I imagine you're trying to find every advantage to achieve high performance. And just like athletes need coaches that are ideally have been previous athletes, so they're able to empathize with the mindset of the athlete and see the blind spots. Is that similar to what the core value of having a CEO coach is?
Yes, absolutely. You want someone who's sort of walked a mile in your shoes, but also someone who is taking a step back and who's able to sort of be thoughtful, and someone who's interested in sort of not the stimulus response of the day-to-day, having an sort of an executive role, but who is really in a place in their career where that they're trying to make sense of it all.
It's a difficult balance, but it's probably a very specialized skill that it's quite hard to find, I imagine.
It is. There are a lot of coaches out there who are sort of in the job because they failed at the job, and you don't want those coaches. There are a lot of people, a lot of, when I really think about management books, so many of them are so theoretical because they're written by academics who've never actually been a manager in any sort of significant way. So you really do, so much of management you learn by doing. But you can learn a lot faster if people who have done the job take the time to take a step back and think about, break the job down and think about what makes people successful for each part of the job.
And so your experience with Google particularly helped a lot, I imagine. And well, your entire brand now is really focusing on giving people feedback, candidly. And I know you had an experience at Google which led you to writing this book. Can you tell this story a little bit for people that may not have heard about how it really all started for you?
Sure, absolutely. Very often when I describe what radical candor is, I like to start by telling a story. And even though radical candor is not about the boss giving the employee feedback, this is what most of us think of and fear, frankly, when we think about feedback. So I'll tell you a story about my boss criticizing me, but I'll have the caveat that the important thing about radical candor starts with soliciting feedback, in particular the boss soliciting feedback. And it's just as much about praise as criticism. But anyway, with that long caveat, here's the story. So I had just started working at Google, and I had to give a presentation to the founders and the CEO of the company about how the AdSense business was doing. And I walked into the room, and there in one corner of the room was Sergey Brin in a blue spandex unitard and toe shoes, kind of stepping away on an elliptical trainer. And there in the other corner of the room was Eric Schmidt, who was CEO at the time, and he was doing his email, and he was so intent, it was like his brain had been plugged into the machine. And I felt a little bit nervous. How in the world was I supposed to get these people's attention? Luckily for me, the AdSense business was on fire, and when I said how many new customers we had added over the last couple of months, Eric almost fell off his chair. He said, "What did you say? This is incredible. Do you need more marketing dollars? Do you need more engineering resources?" So I'm feeling like the meeting's going all right. In fact, I now believe I'm a genius. I walked out of the room. I walked past my boss, who is Sheryl Sandberg, and I'm expecting a high five, a pat on the back. And instead, Sheryl says to me, "Why don't you walk back to my office with me?" And I thought, wow, I have screwed something up, and I'm sure I'm about to hear about it. And Sheryl began the conversation by telling me about the things that had gone well in the meeting, not the things that had gone badly. So again, not in the feedback sandwich, not the kind of, I think there's a less polite term for that, but not in the sort of kiss me, kick me, kiss
me. You can say shit sandwich.
not in the shit sandwich sense of the word. But really seeming to mean what she was saying. But of course, all I wanted to hear about was what I had done wrong. And eventually she said to me, "You said I'm a lot in there. Were you aware of it?" And now I kind of breathed a huge sigh of relief, and I made this brush off gesture with my hand, because if that was all I had done wrong, who really cared when I had a tiger by the tail? And I was like, "Yeah, I know, it's a verbal tick. It's no big deal, really." And then Sheryl said to me, "Well, I know this really great speech coach. I bet I could get Google to pay for it. Would you like an introduction?" And once again, I'm not picking up on the hints. I kind of make this brush off gesture with my hand. And I said, "No, I'm busy. Didn't you hear about all those new customers? I don't have time for a speech coach." And then Sheryl stopped walking. She looked me right in the eye and she said, "I can see when you do that thing with your hand that I'm going to have to be a lot more direct with you. When you say every third word, it makes you sound stupid." Now she's got my full attention.
Yeah.
And some people might say it was mean of Sheryl to say I sounded stupid. But in fact, it was the kindest thing she could have done for me at that moment in my career. Because if she hadn't used just those words with me, and by the way, she wouldn't have used just those words with other people on her team who were maybe better listeners than I was. But if she hadn't used just those words with me, then I never would have gone to see the speech coach, and I wouldn't have learned that she was not exaggerating. I literally said every third word. And this was news to me because I had been giving presentations for my entire career. I had raised millions of dollars for a startup giving presentations. I thought I was pretty good at it. And it was almost like I had been going through my entire career with a giant hunk of spinach in between my teeth, and nobody had the common courtesy to tell me it was there. I could get it out if I knew about it, but I didn't know. And so this really got me to thinking, what was it about Sheryl that made it so seemingly easy for her to tell me, and why had no one else told me? And I realized in the case of Sheryl, it really boiled down to two things. One was she cared about me, and not just me, but all the people who worked directly with her at a very personal level, not just as employees, but as human beings. So, for example, when I first moved from New York to California to take the job, I was very lonely. I didn't really know anyone out here, and I was single. And Sheryl could tell I was lonely, and she introduced me to a book club that I'm still part of to this day. When I had a family member fall ill, Sheryl said to me, "Go get on the plane. Your place is with your family right now. Your team will write your coverage plan. That's what teams do for one another. We have each other's back when we have these kinds of incidents." And that was the kind of thing that she couldn't do, obviously, for all 5,000 people in her organization. Sort of relationships don't scale. But she could do it for all the people who worked directly with her. And when she did, it created a culture of caring, and culture does scale. And it's so important how the leader of an organization treats the people who they work most closely with, because then those people tend to treat their people that way.
Yeah.
There's a real ripple effect. But at the same time, even though Cheryl had our backs and I knew she cared and didn't want to hurt my feelings, I also knew that she would challenge me directly, that if I did something, if I screwed up, she would tell me, and she would keep telling me until I heard it, until it sank, until it penetrated my thick skull. Mm. And so that's really what it boils down to. It is caring personally and challenging directly, and not allowing yourself to feel like there's a false dichotomy between caring and challenging. Challenging is caring. Challenging is a form of caring.
Yeah, it's a tough balance. I imagine people tend to be one way or the other. I can speak for myself, just having employees for my company, that I'm usually, at least I used to be much more less challenging directly, but I would certainly care more personally. And yeah. A lot of the things that you mentioned is through actions, right? And words as well, but actions really tend to show that you really do care. But as I've shifted more into the challenging directly part, I realize that people often get offended still, you know, despite me, maybe I wasn't caring enough personally, at least I didn't show it as well. How do you find, do you have any tips for people that can have difficulty navigating the balance of the two?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, when you, so I think one thing that really helps is to think about what goes wrong when you are so concerned about someone's feelings that you don't tell them something they're better off knowing in the long run. And to even give a name to what happens when we care, but we don't challenge. So in the book, I call that ruinous empathy. And I can tell you a story later about one of my experiences with Please ruinous do. Empathy. But really what happens there is that you don't tell somebody something and in the end you wind up having to fire them. And that's not so nice after all. So remembering that you want to hold on to that desire to be kind at a fundamental level, and that not telling people things is not an act of kindness. So you don't want to let go of your kindness. Now, sometimes you will try to be radically candid with someone, but as you say, they'll get offended. And that means you've landed in what I call obnoxious aggression, where you challenge directly, but they don't feel like you care about them. And it doesn't mean you are obnoxiously aggressive. These are not labels to hang around people's necks. But what it means is that radical candor gets measured not at your mouth, but at someone else's ear. And so when you realize you have landed in obnoxious aggression, the key thing is not to like feel ashamed or feel like you are a jerk, but to realize that what you need to do is adjust how you're talking. And when someone is really upset, either they're angry at you or they're sad or maybe they're crying or whatever, that's your cue to move up on the care personally dimension without backing off of challenge directly. Because if you say, oh, it's okay, it doesn't really matter, it's no big deal, you're just confusing them more, because the reason why you raised it is because it is a big deal. They need to fix it. So you don't want to back off your challenge, but you do want to take a moment and say to the person, name the emotion you're seeing, and name it humbly, because you may be misinterpreting how the person is feeling. So say, it seems like I've upset you, or it seems like I've pissed you off, or whatever it is that you think you're seeing. Very often, we get confused by other people's emotions. So for example, if you give me some feedback and I start to cry, it's not because I'm sad, it's because I'm furious with you. but that's how I express rage, is with tears. And that can be very confusing. There have been other times when I've worked with people and they start yelling at me. And I realize after a little bit that they're yelling at me, not because they're angry, but because they're very upset. So remember that we often misinterpret one another's emotions. So be humble when you state the emotion you think you're seeing. And just eliminate the phrase, don't take it personally, from your vocabulary. You, when you give feedback, you will get some emotional responses. And the only way you can gauge the feedback and get to a better place is to use those emotional responses to improve the way you're communicating with that person.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And I also find whenever you say, don't take it personally, people generally get more personal, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's like that Meatloaf song, you know, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. And sings like, don't be sad. Like, he just told her that he doesn't love her. Of course she's going to be sad. Like, what's the use in saying don't be sad? Telling people how to feel is really a waste of time. Acknowledging how they feel can be very useful for your relationships.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, even like things like, this might sound weird, and because the thing you're triggering now is in people's mind is like they're looking for the weird thing, right? Right before you say it. So you're kind of ruining the whole purpose of that. And, you know, with feedback, it is a tricky process because it seems like you're saying personalize the feedback based on reading people in terms of how they react to your feedback. But for more of a general tip for people when you're giving feedback, maybe not just to employees, but friends, family, and stuff like that, do you generally go with praise first before the criticism, like you mentioned in your story with Google?
So the reason why the shit sandwich doesn't work is because it's a formula. And whenever we're trying to communicate using a formula instead of really paying attention to the person who we're talking to, we're failing to communicate.
What is the shit sandwich, by the way, just for people that don't know?
The shit sandwich is where you start with praise and then you give some criticism and then you end with praise. And which is not to say that that's always the wrong way to do it, but it's definitely not always the right way to do it. So what you want to stay focused on is the other person. And there are some people who you really need to make sure that they know that you have confidence in their abilities. And you need to work really hard to establish that confidence in their abilities. And you give them just the tiniest, most subtle bit of feedback, and that's all they're going to hear. So that's fine if you're dealing, the feedback sandwich can work with people who will hear the criticism if you start with the praise. But there are some people like me, if you give me the shit sandwich, all I'm going to hear is the praise. I'm going to ignore your criticism.
Oh, interesting. So
you need to adjust based on the person. Again, I'm going to say this probably 5 times in the course of this podcast, but radical candor gets measured not at your mouth, but at the other person's ear. And so you can't try to apply some sort of formula because the way the other person is going to respond is unpredictable. And so you need to stay sort of fluid. You can try using improv exercises because feedback is about improv. You don't know what's going to happen. You can't predict what's going to happen, how the other person is going to respond, and you certainly can't try to control it. I think one of the big mistakes people make when they think about feedback is they think if I choose the perfect words, then the other person will hear me and be grateful for the feedback and won't get upset. And that is just bullshit. That is not what's going to happen. Sometimes people will get upset, but that doesn't mean that you can't adjust and fix it. But you need to go in being humble that at best you can control your own, you can manage your own emotional responses, but you cannot make someone else feel a certain way. You can be a jerk, but you cannot make the other person owns their emotions. You cannot control another person's emotions.
Yeah, I mean, with communication, nonverbal is such a big part of it. It's most of it when I imagine for feedback like this. And I would also imagine that people generally look for the criticism, which I guess is why the shit sandwich exists. It's like when people hear feedback, I imagine they will be more self-conscious of the negative criticism that they've heard. than
Some
the positive. Some people
aren't. That's the thing, is you can't generalize about people.
Sure.
It, again, if you tell me something positive and something negative, I will only hear the positive.
That's so interesting. I don't think I know anyone that has that. That's interesting.
Sometimes we all think we're really hard on ourselves and all we want to hear is the negative. And in fact, most of us do have a negativity bias because we learn more from mistakes than from things that go well. But different people are different. And so I do believe that as a general rule, you want to stay focused on the good stuff because as long as if you're firing someone, then there's more bad stuff than good stuff, or there's a bad economy. But usually there's more good things going on than bad things. And usually your job as a leader is to kind of paint a picture of what's possible and to show what success looks like. And praise is your best tool to show what success looks like and to show not only the person who did the good thing, but the whole team. Like, this is what success looks like. So praise is more important and you should give more praise than criticism. You should focus on the good stuff. But that doesn't mean ignore things when they're going right. Sometimes I compare feedback to scratching someone's back. Like if there's an itchy spot on your back, more to the right. No. Up a little higher. You want to give both instructions. You want to say yes, go in that direction. No, don't go in that direction. It's guidance. I often call feedback in the book. I refer to it exclusively as guidance, because feedback is sort of screechy and makes us want to put our hands over our ears. But guidance is something most of us long for. Are we going in the right direction or are we going in the wrong direction? Tell me.
Yeah. I mean, if it is a personalized for each person, because as you said, some people might hear criticism more, some people might hear the positive side more. How does one take actionable steps to make sure that their feedback is, radically candor?
Yeah.
Knowing that they don't know.
Yeah. So one simple way is to ask the person. So at the end of a conversation, you can say, was this helpful? Because your goal in these conversations is to help the person grow. And so you can ask explicitly, but you also, at one point I actually tried to build an app that would prompt people to give you feedback on your feedback. It was very meta. And the fact of the matter is people are uncomfortable enough with feedback. Giving you feedback on their feedback begins to feel like too much.
Yeah.
So you also need to learn how to pick up on the more subtle cues from people. So you want to make sure that you are paying attention, that you're not discounting the emotional responses that you're getting from people. You can also ask them for a plan. So what are we going to do about this? And very often when somebody tells you what they're going to do or what they're not going to do based on what you've said, like when I said to Cheryl, oh, I'm too busy, I'm not going to go to see the speech coach. She knew she hadn't yet achieved radical candor. She was still being ruinously empathetic with me. So she had to go a step further. And so being aware of whether the person is upset and also whether the person has heard you. Far more, I think very often when we go into these feedback conversations, we're afraid that the other person will get upset. But more often than not, what happens is that we say it so gently, the other person hasn't heard us at all. Mm. And when you notice that the other person hasn't heard you, you need to go further. You don't need to attend so much to the care personally dimension. You need to attend to the challenge directly dimension. You need to say it again, sort of like Cheryl said it three times, three different ways to me before she finally got through to me. And so you want to make sure that the person gives you some sign that they've understood, and you want to sort of work with the person. You want to let them know that you're there to help them solve the problem, but the person ultimately has to own solving the problem. So Cheryl yeah. offered the speech coach, for example, and when I said I would go, then she knew she had achieved radical candor with me. Yeah. So looking for not just acknowledgement, but action and change as the result of feedback. And I think another piece of useful advice that Cheryl gave me on responding well to feedback, showing that you've heard it, is that very often it's not enough to correct. You actually have to overcorrect because it feels so uncomfortable. Changing behavior feels so uncomfortable.
Sure.
And so she would often say, you'll know that you have responded well to feedback when someone tells you you've gone too far.
So push the limit.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Maybe you could say one or two ums, Kim. Now you sound like a robot. So you want to make sure that you are working with the person to come up with a plan to fix the problem. And that's why you were sort of alluding before to how it can be sort of confusing, because you don't want to make a personal attack, but you do want to personalize it's just a small semantic difference, but it's a big deal. So you want to make sure you're adjusting for how the person is hearing you, but you don't want to give them feedback on things they can't change, on fundamental personality attributes. So, for example, Cheryl said to me in the meeting, when you said, it made you sound stupid. There's a world of difference between saying that and saying, Kim, the problem with you in this job is that you're too dumb to do it. Like that,
oh,
that
yeah. would not completely be different.
You know, totally different deal. So you want to make sure that you're focusing on the Center for Creative Leadership has a very useful tool, situation behavior impact. In the meeting, when you said every third word, it made you sound stupid. So now that I understood the impact, that was what gave me the motivation to go fix the problem, because I saw the impact that I was going to have on my career and on my ability to get things done.
Yeah, it seems like the big one, that at least the big takeaway for me is when you're giving feedback, stick around to gauge, either ask for more feedback on the feedback, which most people may not want to do, but at least stick around to set up an actionable plan so that you can see the reaction of how people took the feedback. It
yeah.
went through one ear and the other, because they completely dismissed what you said, then probably didn't go through. And if
yeah.
it's the latter, it's completely important. But I wanted to actually ask you, because of how the world is going so remote with COVID, the critical part of what you share in the book is that it has to be in person. And
yeah.
it totally
and
makes
now
sense.
It can't. Now it can't.
And now
it
can't. But in person is so much easier. Even interviews like this is so much easier to read the body language, to get a better sense of the tone of the voice, all of that stuff. But with people working remotely, I mean, I have a remote company from day one as well. So this is particularly something that's curious for me that I'm interested in. How does one shift their strategy if they're a manager or an employer in this new world that we're in?
So I even before COVID, I had an experience where I had to manage remotely because I was pregnant with twins. And I was 40 years old, so I was advanced maternal age. And so it was very high-risk pregnancy. And I had teams in 13 different countries. And I talked to my doctor about whether or not I could travel. And she was like, well, it depends. What's more important to you, the hearts and lungs of your children or these business trips? I'm like, okay, I'm not traveling. So I sort of had to manage remotely for most of the pregnancy. And then also, I did go on a full 5 month maternity leave. But after maternity leave, I just wasn't able to travel as much. And so here's what I learned in that period of time. One thing is that there's a hierarchy of mediums. And so a video call gets you maybe 60, 70% there in terms of reading body language, seeing the expression on someone's face, understanding a little bit how your words are landing for that person. It's way better than a phone call, but a phone call is way better than any kind of asynchronous communication, texting or email or whatever. So you want to have these conversations, these kind of feedback conversations, synchronously. And that is the most important thing. The other thing that I learned is you need to really create sort of in the story I told, in the story I told, Cheryl said, walk back to my office with me. And you're not going to do that in quarantine, but you do want to make sure, for reasons of giving feedback, but also for reasons of just managing your energy throughout the day, you want to make sure you have a few minutes of Slack time in between meetings so that you can call someone right after a meeting and have a quick chat. So you want to build some Slack time into your schedule. It's really important. Another thing that I learned when managing a remote team is that it is really helpful to have more frequent one-on-ones, more frequent, shorter one-on-ones. So if you have only, if you have a 50-minute one-on-one once a week when you're in person, when you're not in person, it's better maybe to have 3 15-minute one-on-ones throughout the week to do more quick. Because if you're only talking to someone once a week, one-on-one, you're not getting any of the emotional tenor of the things that are happening throughout the week. You're just getting that one snapshot of how the person is doing. So I think talking to people more often. I once worked in Moscow, and my boss was in New York, and he used to call me every morning. And there was a big time zone problem, right, also. Mm. But he used to call me as soon as he woke up. Before he would even get out of bed, he would talk to me. And this was really important because just that 5 minutes, it wasn't like a big burden on him. It wasn't a scheduled thing. So if I was in a meeting or something, it was okay if I didn't take the call. But just that ability to check in, because things were a little tense in Moscow at that time. This was 1992, 93. And, so it was useful to just check in, and I was there alone, so it was really good to have that quick touch point every day. So the short meetings are a big deal. The other thing that is a really big deal if you have time zone problems, if people are in different countries, is to work. The problem is you don't have much synchronous overlap in your schedules often. And so I would work 1 week per quarter European hours and 1 week per quarter Asian hours. And it was terrible to go into the office at 2 a.m. or whatever that meant I had to do. But it was a lot less bad than traveling. And it was possible. I just couldn't travel. So that was actually really helpful. And another thing that I learned that was helpful to sort of recreate some of the texture of the real world is that sometimes I would have tea with people and we would both have our cups of tea, and sometimes I would take a walk with someone and we would be, in this case, sort of not on video usually, because that would mean we would trip and fall.
Yeah.
But this is especially in the COVID era where we're all sitting in front of these Zoom screens or Google Hangout screens or Skype screens or whatever technology we're using all day long. Yeah. I think that is bad. Like, that is just bad for your brain. And so I've really encouraged people to take walking one-on-ones. So you want to trade off between the benefits of seeing someone in person, but also the benefits of giving someone a break to take a walk. Sorry, that's my dog in the background. To take a walk, to get outside, to get some natural sunlight. So sometimes that's a trade-off worth making.
Yeah, I had an employee once who we brought on, and she definitely was not used to working remotely. And I'm sure a lot of people are going through this right now. So I was so used to it because we've been 2 years remotely. So we brought this new person on, and she kept wanting to talk afterwards. So we scheduled at 15 minutes, and in the beginning I went long. I went 25 minutes, and we made sure that, I was showing that I was personally interested. But after like 6 months, it just kept dragging on.
Yeah.
And it was very uncomfortable for me to tell her, like, listen, this, because it's remote also, I wanted to feel really comfortable, but it was a very uncomfortable conversation where I had to tell her, like, listen, like, I have meetings after this as well, and I would love to catch up, but we kind of need to keep that part over Slack. And especially with remote, I felt like giving feedback and that kind of feedback was very difficult. And I'm sure a lot of managers now are certainly going through that, even just remote employees that are giving feedback to each other and coworkers and stuff.
Yeah, I think especially right now when different people have such different demands on their time and needs for social interaction, it's really tricky. So there are some people I work with who really need to talk because they're living alone, right? Mm. And so this, our calls are, you know, they'll become like a social call as well as and a human lifeline. And I want to give that to people. At the same time, I have young children at home, and like every minute of my day, and I'm trying to finish a book, and every minute of my day is spoken for. And frankly, I have more, you know, I'm long human interaction. what I really want is a little time alone.
Sure.
And so I think being respectful of each other's sort of needs, like I just try to be explicit about it. I'm like, the greatest gift you can give me is 10 minutes of free time. Like,
yeah.
There's nothing nicer you could do for me. Like, and sometimes that sounds a little harsh, but it's my reality. And I think being able to share different realities with different people. And like, I can see that either people I work with or friends of mine are really lonely, I'll try to put them in touch, because I know that I can't right now, offer the kind of companionship that they need. And it's a tricky thing right now, because a lot of work is social, and that has disappeared, that social part. And it's important to be sensitive to people's needs, but also to assert your own. Like, I can't spend an extra 15 minutes on the video call with you.
And it's weird, because I find it way easier to give another man feedback like that. And I feel that, I don't know, it's probably just in my head at the end of the day, right? Whereas like when I have a female employee, I feel like I have to be a little bit more sensitive, and I have to be kind of go around it. So I find myself actually not being so radically candor with female employees versus male employees, just because I've given feedback directly to my male friends and they've generally taken it well. So I'm used to that habit of just like, listen, man, and we can talk directly. Whereas a female, apart from a girlfriend, which can get very emotional, that's like the memory that I have. And I'm not sure if females feel the same way when giving feedback to males versus females. What have been your experience around that?
Yeah, so this is the topic of my whole next book. So you're going to have a hard time shutting me up.
Beautiful.
This is something I can't care a lot about. So I think one of the things that happens is it is hard to be radically candid with someone who looks like you. It's even harder to be radically candid with someone who doesn't look like you, especially in today's environment, because I think a lot of us are afraid of looking like a sexist or a racist or a homophobe, and the vast majority of people really don't want to be those things, really aren't those things. Yeah. And yet we all do things that are racist, that are sexist. And when we do, most of us feel a great sense of shame. And when we're in shame, we're in this sort of lockdown, and we're in a situation of amygdala hijack. Like our cognitive, our prefrontal cortex is not firing. We're deep in a lizard brain in fight or flight response.
Yeah.
And so I have several bits of advice for sort of managing this, because it's really important. I think one of the things that there's a lot of research that shows this, that one of the things that really holds underrepresented people back in their careers is that they don't get as much feedback from their bosses. So it's really important that you as a manager give the women on your team just as clear feedback as you give the men on your team. It's really important that I, as a white person, give the people of color on my team just as clear feedback as I give the other white people on my team, so on and so forth. But it's really hard. It's really, it's much harder. And so I think that one of the suggestions that I say to men is that, first of all, it's your job to give everybody equally clear feedback. Second of all, you're very often afraid that a woman will cry if you give her feedback. If, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think a lot of men are. And I think that at least maybe this says more about me than men or women, but the men who've worked for me have cried just as often as the women who've cried for me.
Oh, like really?
Men cry too. I've got news for you. And also, like, even if the woman does cry, you are not water soluble. You will not melt. It's not the end of the world. Like, you can sure. deal with it. And so sort of learning to accept the different kinds of emotions, but also learning not to gender stereotype the kind of emotions that you might get. But at the same time, I do want to acknowledge it's harder. It is harder to give feedback to someone who looks different from you. So it's like one of the things you have to learn to do and push yourself to do yeah. as a leader. So that's one of the suggestions I make to men. Another thing that happens, I think, for women is very often I have found in my career when I am being radically candid, I get unjustly accused of obnoxious aggression because people expect women to be gentler, kinder, not to challenge them directly. And usually when that happens, I don't get called obnoxiously aggressive, I get called bitchy or abrasive or something like that. And that's painful. It makes it very tempting. You know, I get called unlikable. And when you get called something like that, it's very tempting to move the wrong direction on challenge directly. And that's a huge mistake because then I wind up obnoxious aggression is bad, but if I go the wrong way on challenge directly, I wind up in ruinous empathy or the other quadrant, which is what I call manipulative insincerity, where you're neither caring nor challenging. And those places are even worse than obnoxious aggression. So what I try to do in those cases is to take a moment to show that I care, like not too much of a moment. I don't need to go baking cupcakes for the whole office or anything like that, because then I'll just be pissed off. Mm-hmm. But to say, look, I can see that you really care about this podcast. I want you to make it much better, and I have the suggestion that I think will help. So just take a moment to say that you care. So I think those dynamics are really important to be aware of. And I think also if you're a woman working for a man, it's important to know that he's going to have a harder time giving you feedback and to pull it out of him. And it's also really important to distinguish between legitimate feedback and gender-biased feedback. So I had a boss once who said, you know, you're struggling with the competence likability bias. And he was putting it on me and the competence likability bias basically means the more competent a woman is, the more likable she is, the less people are like her, the more unlikable she is. So the more competent, the less people like her. So that's a hard bind to be in because I'm good at my job and so you hate me because I'm good at my job. Like, that's not really fair. And so he told me this and then he was like, so, and I thought he was going to deal with the bias, you know, and instead he was like, so can you try to be more likable? I was like, that's bullshit. You know, it is your job as a leader to create an environment in which bias doesn't play out. It is not my job to tiptoe through the tulips of your team's gender bias.
That doesn't make any sense. He's basically, by saying that there's that the more competent you are, that less people like you, he's basically asking you to do a worse job in your role so that you can become more likable.
Yes, it makes no sense, but a lot of things don't make any sense. Okay. A lot of things are ridiculous. He didn't actually, in the end, what he did was he said, well, maybe if I give you a demotion, then they'll be less jealous of you. I'm like,
Jesus.
You know, I quit.
Yeah, we're far behind of reaching that kind of equality in the workplace. And yeah. I imagine now that we're going remote and with all the commotion that's going on with Black Lives Matter and counterculture, like it's just kind of exponentially put on top of each other. So your message is probably more relevant than ever for anyone that is kind of going through this right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. I'm sort of optimistic about that we will take a step in the right direction as a culture, and that Black Lives Matter and Me Too and these movements that are really making it impossible to overlook the way that bias and prejudice play out in our lives.
Yeah.
And also giving people more permission to confront these problems in the workplace. So I'm in that sense, I'm optimistic that change will happen. But I do think that being remote makes it much harder. To start to make that kind of change. And we're already seeing a lot of examples of and a lot of data that show that women tend to get fired faster than men in an economic crisis. Underrepresented minorities tend to get fired faster than white people. And so we really need to start to track and measure the way that our often unconscious biases turn into what I call unconscious discrimination. And we need to point it out and to be unflinching in our willingness to call these problems out, because it's a big deal. I mean, I think another thing that managers can do in COVID to create more radical candor on their teams is to be aware of how much airtime people take in meetings, for example, because very often you have a bloviating bully on the team who talks, you know, there's a team of 10 people and one person's talking 60% of the time, and you don't get the best teamwork. There's a lot of evidence that shows that when everyone on a team makes a contribution, the team performs much better. When one person dominates, the team performs much worse. It's true of sports teams. It's also true of teams in business. And so you want to make sure, and invariably, the bloviating bully is not the Black woman on your team. I'll put it that way. The bloviating bully is usually someone who's not even aware that they're hogging all the airtime, but who's just been always given the floor their whole life.
Sure.
And so making sure that you're aware of those kinds of dynamics, and it's hard to get a word in edgewise in person, it's even harder over video.
Beautiful. Well, Kim, I really enjoyed this conversation. As I mentioned, this is more relevant than ever during these times, as people go remote, as people are dealing with all this commotion that's happening. I'd love to get an actionable piece of advice for listeners or people that are watching this. There's something that they can do as soon as they finish watching or listening to this that they can take action on to become more radically candor, whether it's, because we talked a lot about, obviously entrepreneurs, we talked a lot about managers in this conversation, but I also want to try to make it applicable as possible, because people may want to transfer this knowledge into giving feedback to their spouse, to their friends, and I really wanted to go into, because I have a very specific case of a thing that I'm dealing with a friend, and I don't know how to give them feedback, but something that you can share for people to do, something small but actionable after they listen to this.
Yes, I will say that very often when I give a talk about radical candor, somebody will come up to me afterwards and they'll say, oh, if only I had heard this 5 years ago, I wouldn't be divorced right now. So it works at home too. It works with your friends, works with your family. So here is my advice. The right place, there's an order of operations to radical candor, and it all starts with soliciting feedback, not with giving it. And so decide right now, who are you going to ask to give you feedback, and what's the question you're going to use. So, and I'll give you one that I like, but you've got to come up with your question. So a question that I like to use is, what could I do or stop doing that would make it easier to work with me, but, or make it easier to be my friend, or make it easier to stay married to me, or what, whoever you're asking. And the there's a few key elements in this. The first is that the question needs to sound like you. So for example, I worked with Krista Quarles when she was the CEO of OpenTable. And she said, I could never imagine asking that question. Those words just wouldn't come out of my mouth. The question I like to ask is, tell me why I'm smoking crack. Okay, that's a fine way to ask the question too, but it's got to sound like you. And don't ask that question to someone who has a drug problem, by the way.
Yeah.
So you want to be sensitive. So you want to make sure that you are asking a question that sounds like you. That's number one. You want to make sure that your question can't be answered by, oh no, everything's fine. So if you say, do you have any feedback for me? You are wasting your breath, because I can already tell you what the answer is. Oh no, everything's fine. So you want to make sure that you're asking the question in a way that is open-ended enough that is going to elicit an answer. And then you want to adjust the question for that person. So go out and ask for feedback. And after you ask your question, shut your mouth and count to six.
Mm. Yes. And I would love to refer the one of my favorite quotes, which is going to be paraphrased by Tim Ferriss, which is, a person's success in life can usually be measured by the number of uncomfortable conversations he or she is willing to have. So whoever is out there is thinking that it's going to be really uncomfortable, that's kind of the point. And it's shown that you're probably going to have a more successful and better life because of it.
Yes, absolutely. Change is uncomfortable, but it is necessary.
Beautiful. Well, Kim, thanks so much for making the time to chat. Where can people find you online? Where can people learn more about Radical Candor, your next book, and so forth? We'll link all that below.
RadicalCandor.com is a great place to look for more. There's also at Kim Ball Scott is my Twitter handle, or at Candor is Radical Candor's Twitter handle.
Nice. You guys got at Candor.
Yes.
Beautiful. Wow. Was that from the relationship with Dick?
No. Not taken. Whatever.
I'm just kidding. All right, Kim. Well, thanks so much for coming on. Thanks so much for tuning in, guys. And I'll see you next week.
Take care.
Thanks for making it all the way to the end of the show. Hope you really enjoyed our guest today and that you took one thing valuable from our conversation. If you haven't already, I would love it if you could leave a quick rating or review on whichever network you're listening to the show, and share this episode with one friend if you found it valuable. And if it's something that a friend, a family member, or just someone that you care about could find a little bit of insight from what you learned today. All right. Ciao.